To open this second issue of Audio Digest Psychiatry and to provide the theme and the theses of our two debaters, let's hear again a real case, outlined but not clinically solved, on our introductory welcome tape and read by our program interlocutor, Charlotte P. Ross, Executive Director of the Suicide Prevention Center of San Mateo County, California.
This is a true case which exposes the ambivalence of suicide in sharp focus. My patient with multiple personality had a very ambivalent wish to die. Mary number one wished to live. Mary number two announced to me at an appointment that she had a gun waiting for her when she left the office. She had, in fact, jumped off a cliff 2 days earlier but survived. I kept Mary number one and number two, being housed in the same body, on an involuntary hold for 72 hours. Before the 72 hours expired, Mary number one reemerged and expressed great relief that Mary number two had not killed the two of her. Her gratitude is not the issue, however. Please tell me how your philosophy can help solve a dilemma like this. Which Mary has the right to suicide, and with whom shall a therapist align? Shall we agree with whichever personality happens to emerge in a given session? Do we have a responsibility and charge for Mary number one to help protect her from Mary number two? If we allow Mary number two freedom to suicide, since Mary number two and number one are really only one highly ambivalent person, who shall really be free? And if we allow Mary number two to emigrate, are we not preventing number one from returning home?
The poles apart stances that our two debaters take on the issue of suicide prevention is perhaps well epitomized in their responses to how they would handle the case of the two Marys. First, from Thomas S. Saws, Professor of Psychiatry, State University Hospital, Upstate Medical Center, Syracuse, New York.
This whole question is very difficult to answer in this form because it's already been couched in such a way that there are two Marys, and therefore the question has got me against the ropes if I have to answer within this framework. In a political framework, in a civil rights framework, there's only one person, a person with gravely mixed feelings about a great many issues. Now, within that context, I will, if I can translate back into plain English, I'll be glad to answer it. Where is the problem? Let's assume that this were my patient. I can only tell you what I would do, and whatever this doctor who asks my general view would be, he can do what he wants. I'm not quite sure what he's asking. I have an understanding with a patient, and this often happens before the patient even comes, but certainly as soon as anything like this comes up, an understanding, you can call it a contract, that the only thing I do, absolutely only thing, is listen, talk, and collect money. So there's no problem. I no more intervene in suicide than in anything else. This is a pseudo problem. Now, if the doctor has an understanding with the patient that when an ambivalent situation of suicide is prevented, he is to act on the side of preventing suicide rather than saying it's your business, then that's his duty. This is a question of what kind of contract. What is he selling to this patient? If the patient is buying this kind of an infantile kind of an arrangement that, you know, when I am in doubt and I feel like killing myself, you'll stop me. This is essentially an alcoholic game, which, you know, is well known, which Eric Byrne described in rather cute terms. You know, if some wife wants to play with her husband the game of hiding bottles around the house, well, they are welcome to that. That's their business. If some doctor wants to play this kind of suicide game, I will prevent you from killing yourself, more luck to them. In my own view, I do not think it is politically, morally legitimate, legally, to have involuntary psychiatric interventions. So if society, if social rules were modified and involuntary interventions were abolished, then to some extent this doctor's question would be quite different. Because if then he would prevent Mary number, whichever it is, the one who wants to kill herself, and would hospitalize her, then Mary number one would be in a wonderful position to collect $1 million by turning around and suing him for an illegal act. And I very much hope that we will get to that. See, if somebody is ambivalent, if somebody goes to a doctor with a terrible gallbladder, a middle-aged lady, and, you know, has a long negotiation with the surgeon and says, I really don't know what to do. Should I have it out? Shouldn't I have it out? And the doctor can't stand it, gets nervous, and, you know, restrains the patient, takes her to the hospital and has the gallbladder out. You know what will happen to the doctor. So this is really, you have to simply think more about this question in terms of the moral and legal issues, not in terms of how many Marys there are, because that's already psychiatrizing it. There is only one Mary.
On the opposing side of the debate, is suicide prevention a myth or a mandate? Edwin S. Schneidman, professor of medical psychiatry at the University of California, Los Angeles.
I happen to be an American psychologist who is taking the position that lives in balance ought to be saved. I happen to know the question about that dissociative girl, from whom it comes and what it represents. That's a cop-out, that answer, and I find myself somewhat troubled and puzzled that he would see someone who cries for help if they're willing to underwrite that contract with money. And I put it in my own mind this way, that anyone who comes for help, implicitly, there's a contract in the air. I put this in my own paper, that one ought not ordinarily abrogate the position in which he is put as helper. I don't see that as undemocratic. I see a great difference between parent and child, and I think that the notions of democracy, which I prize highly, can be distorted easily. If you think that you're a co-equal with your child, you'll scare and abrogate some of the opportunities for responsibility which you have as a parent. Now, this philosophy obviously pervades my work in suicide prevention. I don't know how it pervades others. To say that suicide prevention centers is a manufacturing of illness by American psychiatry is shrill.
And shrill may be at times the best adjective to describe these two debaters' defenses of their positions, as on the one hand, Dr. Saws accuses the suicide preventer of saying, give him commitment, give him electroshock, give him lobotomy, give him lifelong slavery, but do not let him choose death. While at the other end of the philosophical spectrum, Dr. Schneidman maintains that, as part of saving lives, we may very well have to kill the straw men that stand in the way of common sense action and benign intervention. From a University of California, San Francisco day-long seminar, this issue of Audio Digest Psychiatry brings you the highlights of the defense of these two positions, condensing 8 hours of panelist and audience freewheeling discussion into the 1 hour that you're hearing now. Returning to the opening statement of the two principal participants, we hear first Dr. Saws.
Obviously, if suicide is not an illness, one has to have some other interpretation of it. Now, my interpretation of it is that it's by and large simply an expression of the fact that human beings are free to do all kinds of things, including killing themselves. In other words, suicide has, in some very fundamental way, have to do with personal autonomy, with the fact that one is one's own master. Now, this idea is, unfortunately, hardly original with me. I wish it were. I think it was Aristotle, or it's not Aristotle, some compatriot of his, and about the same time, who, while he believed that slavery was natural and slaves ought to be slaves because that somehow is the natural order and that's how God created them, he justified this ingenious view in a rather ingenious way. Namely, that slaves have such a stupid mentality that if they were like free men, obviously they would not remain slaves but would kill themselves to frustrate their masters. And since they don't generally do this, this proves that they ought to be slaves. Now, as you know, in Greek ethic, suicide was not an absolutely bad thing. And in fact, to lead a morally dignified life was far more important. And the culture hero of the entire Western world was a person, Socrates, who chose, in effect, suicide, execution, in preference to banishment, which, after all, is a form of life and which could have been commuted and so forth. So Socrates is a suicide. Not to mention that, after all, the early Christians, who preferred to be killed rather than to be the loyal, converted, heathen subjects of the emperor, in effect, committed suicide by preferring a certain kind of dignified death to life at any cost. And of course, I quote in my article, Patrick Henry's phrase, give me liberty or give me death. Now, obviously, this is a quasi-suicidal statement in a patriotic context. The point I'm making, then, that suicide is a very dramatic expression of the fact that the person, in effect, says, look, I am my own master and you can't bother me. And since there is an infinite human passion in the human bosom to bother other people and to control them, obviously, I think this is the reason why we don't like suicide. Now, this is very easy to illustrate. Perhaps the best illustration or an easy one for this is the infinite pains to which people have gone in the Western world to prevent condemned prisoners from killing themselves. an obscenity. Now, why? If somebody is condemned to death, if what the state wants, if what society wants, is that they should die, after all, one could put a bottle of sleeping pills in their cell and let them kill themselves. That, in effect, is how Socrates was treated. He was given poison, which he himself drank. He was not beheaded. He was not hanged. The brutalization of killing the person was not gone through. What we don't want is the fact that the condemned person cannot kill himself, but society is going to butcher him, is an expression of the fact that he does not control himself. We do. Now, a rather cute example of this is the story, the case of Hermann Göring, whose last heroic or unheroic act was to frustrate the American authorities, who had these high-ranking Nazis all caged in Nuremberg. And since we won, fortunately, we could declare them to have committed crimes against humanity, which is, after all, a luxury of victors. And as a part of this, obviously, we're going to kill them. And there were immense precautions, because it was well known that as part of the Nazi stoical ethic, which I am hardly here to extol, they believed that suicide was preferable to some kind of ignominious death. And it was quite routine for them to have cyanide capsules in their possession. And they were searched for this. And I guess Göring's was hidden in one of his bodily orifices. At least that's the only presumption, where it was not discovered. And as you know, well along during the Nuremberg trials, while they were in process, I think more than halfway through, I'm not entirely clear on this particular detail, it's not important. One morning, Göring killed himself. And it is quite obvious that this was a victory for Göring and no one else. And that in this sense, suicide was a very dramatic expression of his own autonomy. Of course, similarly, Hitler and all the other leaders killed themselves not to fall into captivity. And of course, it's an old, old military idea that leading generals, leading statesmen, and so on, kill themselves rather than be captured. At the point of utter defeat, they kill themselves. And in Japan, of course, this is still quite accepted. But I don't have to digress into the comparative anthropology of suicide. I mean, no one in this country really defends the idea that suicide is mental illness or bad everywhere. I mean, that would be a very difficult point to maintain. And I want to read to you one other story which illustrates in a dramatic way the principle that the ends justify the means in this business. And really, no one questions this. I think that is really, well, no one, I mean, you know, generally people don't question this. This is generally accepted. Otherwise, how else does one explain stories like this? And these are, after all, fairly routine. I clip these things from the paper as they strike my fancy about some of these subjects. This is from the New York Times only a couple of months ago. Policeman, priest thwarts a suicide. This is the title of the piece, New York Times. Policeman, priest in quotes, thwarts a suicide. Somerville, Massachusetts, the Associated Press. A policeman posing as a Roman Catholic priest. So we begin with a crassly immoral and illegal act. This is where we start. A policeman posing as a Roman Catholic priest talked a distraught husband threatening suicide into surrendering a pistol. The man, identified as Ernest Gibbons of Newton, Kansas, was taken to Cambridge City Hospital for psychiatric observation, translate psychiatric imprisonment. The police gave this account of the incident. Mr. Gibbons appeared at his estranged wife's home recently and after a discussion produced a .38 caliber pistol. He threatened to kill himself. Mrs. Gibbons, mother of a child, screamed and neighbors called the police, who said that when they arrived, Mr. Gibbons had the muzzle of the gun in his mouth. For 3 hours, the police sought unsuccessfully to persuade him to surrender. At length, Bernard Regan, a patrolman, went to nearby St. Joseph's Rectory and asked for a cassock and Roman collar, saying the man's life was at stake. Dressed as a priest, Mr. Regan talked his way into Mrs. Gibbons' home and negotiated with her husband for an hour. However, he suddenly realized that he had forgotten to take off his wedding ring. And that the blue piping of his police trousers were showing beneath his cassock. But Mr. Gibbons apparently wasn't paying attention to that. Mr. Regan said Mr. Gibbons made the discovery at about the same time, cocked the pistol and pointed it at him, then apparently at second thoughts, and let the loaded weapon fall to the floor. Other officers rushed in and overpowered Mr. Gibbons. Now, I won't belabor this. What else is there to say? It really is a question of, do these ends justify such means? Now, while we are on the issue of religion, let me add one more thing to this. which I think is an important point. I suppose if it wouldn't come up now, it would come up later. But let me add that I have really no objection. That's putting it mildly. I'm quite in favor of having clear religious and moral rules, which, of course, are quite separate from legal rules in a society that's not theological. In other words, the idea that suicide is a sin is quite nice. It's not my personal view, but that makes sense to me. Now, of course, that means really two things. And I want to hammer this point home to show really how far the psychiatric ideology of fraudulence has carried even religion and how religion has come out. It really means two things if you think that suicide is bad. Of course, first of all, it means that you yourself don't do it. That's what a moral rule means. Not that you impose it on someone, but that you don't do it. Secondly, it means that you have appropriate theological, religious sanctions. Now, this is not something esoteric we are talking about. It. We are talking about here, what I am talking about here, is the fact that it is part and parcel of the Roman Catholic religion that the person who commits suicide commits a grievous sin against his religion, against God, and the penalty for this is that the priest must not bury him in religious ceremony. This is a prescribed penalty. This penalty, of course, used to be routinely enforced, carried out. As far as I know, in the last good many decades, certainly in New York State, upstate New York especially, which is a heavily Catholic area, nothing like this would ever occur to anyone, because we now live, including the clergy, live in a very enlightened age. They all do what the American Medical Association, whenever it's called upon, denounces this practice, although obviously all psychiatrists love to engage in it, and that is the making of a retrospective psychiatric diagnosis about somebody who is dead. When the Catholic clergy is now faced with a Catholic who committed suicide, they bury him, as they do everyone else, because obviously the person killed himself while insane, and therefore he committed no sin.
Thank you, Dr. Saz. Now, with his philosophy of suicide prevention, Dr. Schneidman.
My opponent in this debate is an acknowledged, experienced physician, a brilliant intellect, an articulate exponent of his own position, and a well-publicized polemicist. On the other hand, it is clear in my mind that the burden of the main position which he seriously espouses in print and on this platform on the topic of suicide prevention is philosophically naive, clinically flawed, therapeutically inimical, badly informed, speciously reasoned, and ethically troublesome. I am appalled, I guess you might say I have deep moral indignation, at the potential for mischief and neglect which I find in his position relative to suicide prevention. Now, it's not only fair, but it seems required that at the outset I lay out some of the tenets of my own position in relation to suicide. First, I would begin by defining suicide as the intentioned act of self-destruction. It is not a disease, although one can, if one looks hard enough, find some who think so. It is not an immorality, although it's often been so treated. And it is unlikely that any one theory can ever explain phenomena as varied and complicated as human self-destructive acts. At the least, suicide involves an individual's tortured and tunneled logic in a state of intolerable, inner felt, idiosyncratically defined anguish. I am a devout believer, as a citizen, as a psychologist, and as a suicidologist, in Justice Cardozo's ringing judgment that a cry for help is a summons to rescue. In this setting, I wish to focus briefly on three general psychological features which I consider to be characteristics of suicidal phenomena. The first is that acute suicidal crisis, or the period of high and dangerous lethality, is an interval of relatively short duration, to be counted typically in hours or days, not usually in terms of months or years. An individual is at the peak of his self-destructiveness for a very brief time and is either helped, cools off, or is dead. Although one can live for years at a chronically somewhat elevated self-destructive level, one cannot, in a state of heightened lethality, have a loaded gun to one's head for too long before either bullet or affect is discharged. The key question is, if it is true that the acute suicidal interval is a relatively short one, then why in the name of common sense and humanity would anyone focus on an individual's wishes to kill himself during that relatively brief period in his life and disregard the vast panoply and remainder of his existence, especially when the potential rescuer knows that the potential victim will, given some appropriate response, change the balance of forces within his own mind and himself wish to continue to live. I receive no sense from reading Dr. Saw's materials that he is aware of this key characteristic of suicide, nor aware of the concept of gradations of lethality. The second concept is ambivalence. In this audience, few people would dispute that Freud's major insights relating to the role of unconscious motivation and the workings of what we can call the unconscious mind have been one of the giant ideas of this century, revolutionizing our ideas of man. Dr. Littman's paper on Freud and suicide is already an acknowledged classic, and I recommend it to you. The notion of ambivalence is a critical concept in 20th century psychodynamically oriented psychiatry and psychology. The dualities, complications, concomitant contradictory feelings, attitudes, and thrust toward essentially the same person or introjected image is a recognized hallmark of psychological life. These dualities in the mind's flow constitute a cardinal feature of man's inner life. One can no longer ask, in an Aristotelian way, to make up your mind. To such a question, a sophisticated respondent ought to say, but that is precisely the point. I am at least of two, perhaps several minds on this subject. Dr. Murray has described this internal flux, the mental flux, as the Congress of the mind. Now, I need to point out that actions, to pull a trigger or not to, are characteristically dichotomous. But the debate which leads up to an action can, in the Congress of the mind, be a very complicated set of inner dialogues. A law has equal force whether it is passed in the Senate by a 100-0 or a 51-49 vote. So has a bullet. The paradigm of suicide is not the simplistic one of wanting to or not wanting to, as that view proclaims. There is a confusion of the conjunction. There is a great difference between love or marriage and love and marriage. The prototypical psychological picture of a person on the brink of suicide is one who wants to and doesn't want to. He makes plans for self-destruction and at the same time entertains fantasies of rescue and intervention. It is perfectly possible, indeed probably prototypical, for a suicidal individual to cut his throat and to cry for help at the same time. What would one do with a person on a ledge? That person wants to die or he wouldn't be on the ledge. He'd be inside the building. And that person wants to live or he wouldn't be on the ledge. He'd be splattered on the pavement below. Should one ask the person what he wanted? Obviously, the person on the ledge is conflicted. Or should one reach out at all, be a good Samaritan, a benign intervener, even if it meant restricting that person's freedom for a moment? Or should one just leave him to continue his inner debate, perhaps to jump? Or even to slip or fall. The third characteristic I want to mention is that most suicidal events are dyadic events. That is, they are two-person events. Actually, this dyadic aspect of suicide itself has two aspects. One during the prevention of suicide, when one must deal with a significant other. And the second aspect is in the aftermath of a committed suicide, in which one ought to deal with a survivor victim. Although it is obvious that the suicidal drama takes place within an individual's head, it is also true that most suicidal tensions are between two people, typically rather well known to each other, spouse and spouse, parent and child, lover and lover. Even if we wanted to, neither Dr. Saz nor I could deny the cold sociological truth that some modes of death are more stigmatizing to the survivors than are other modes of death. And generally speaking, suicide imposes the greatest stigma of all upon its survivors. But mostly, the analysis of Dr. Saw's paper on suicide leads me to say that he comes across as being oxymoronic. Now, before you gasp, thinking that I am impugning his fine intelligence, I hasten to state that an oxymoron is defined as a combination of contradictory or incongruous words used for epigrammatic effect. The one example given in the Webster's Dictionary of oxymoron is cruel kindness. It describes Dr. Sazer's position rather well. In the English literature, perhaps the best-known oxymoronic passages appear in Romeo and Juliet. O heavy lightness, serious vanity, feather of lead, bright smoke, cold fire, sick health, beautiful tyrant, fiend angelical, and parting is such sweet sorrow. Dr. Sazer's basic oxymoronic position is as follows. It has the compassion of concern combined with the possibility of disregard. It invokes the image of a savior of disinterest, a saint of turning one's back, one that might let you drown in a sea of his high principle. While it espouses liberty, it contains a perversion, I believe, of the notion of democracy by forgetting the basic psychological truth that not all pairs of human beings are equally needful at any given time, like parent and infant, healer and sick, helper and perturbed, therapist and potentially suicidally inclined person. There is the flavor in it of the double-binding pseudo-rescuer. As a physician, it seems to be saying, come, let me be indifferent to your ultimate fate. As a psychiatrist, it seems to be saying, come, let me disregard your keenest ambivalences. As a citizen, it seems to be saying, come, let me be deaf to your cry for help. Dr. Saz further says that they, physicians, when they are threatened by an individual suicide, quote, strike and strike back hard. I'm still quoting. This explains why psychiatrists and suicidologists resort, apparently with a perfectly clear conscience, to the vilest methods. They must believe that their lofty end justifies the basest means. Hence the prevalent use of force and fraud in suicide prevention. Close quote. There's an attempt in that article to discredit by association suicide prevention with evil, force, fraud, deception. To quote further from that article, one of the more demagogic sentences, quote, the suicidologist stands Patrick Henry's famous exclamation, give me liberty or give me death on its head. I'm quoting. In effect, he says, give him commitment, give him electroshock, give him lobotomy, give him lifelong slavery, but do not let him choose death. He further says, quote, the pseudo-medical perspective is then used to justify psychiatric deception and coercion of the crudest sort. I'm quoting, understand that deception is standard practice in suicide prevention centers, though this is often denied. Close quote. As some of you may know, I was co-director of a suicide prevention center for some years and then head of a national program on this topic. I don't know what he's talking about when he screams, the printed text is filled with his italics, about lobotomy, shock, and slavery. Most of the actual suicide prevention in this country, almost all of it in Great Britain, is done by non-professional volunteers in suicide prevention and crisis centers and in the Samaritans. To my knowledge, not one of them has ever administered or prescribed an electric coma or performed a lobotomy.
Excuse me, Dr. Schneidman, long enough to say that this doctor is the end of this side of your reel. To hear the continuation of this debate on suicide prevention, simply reverse the cassette or two reels on your tape recorder. Continuing the highlights of a debate on the ethics and morality of suicide prevention, this is Side B, Audio Digest Psychiatry, Volume 1, Number 2. Returning now to the voice of Dr. Edwin S. Schneidman and further references to Dr. Saz's writings.
Now, because that article quotes from Patrick Henry, I am emboldened to extend this lesson in American history to clarify the syntax. As an amateur student of American history, it seems evident to me that give me liberty or give me death was never meant as a simple alternative. Dr. Sires is confused again about that conjunction. Patrick Henry's statement was meant as a credo, a challenge, a battle cry. It does not say, if you do not give me liberty, then please give me death. Rather, it declares, specifically to the then English king, that you had better give us liberty or we shall fight for our liberty. Liberty and life are on both sides of that conjunction. I puzzle as to why Dr. Sires's position precludes putting life on both sides of his compound sentences. Now, I want to quote another paragraph from Dr. Sires. Dr. Sires says, for the sake of emphasis, and I might say this is just after he has said suicide prevention is erroneous and evil, because it serves to legitimize psychiatric fraud and force, but I'm now quoting him again, let me state that I consider counseling, persuasion, psychotherapy, or any other voluntary measure, especially for persons troubled by their own suicidal inclinations or seeking such help, unobjectionable and indeed generally desirable interventions. That's from Dr. Sires. If he is for persuasion, including the persuasion to live, what then are the relationships between persuasion and voluntary measures? How persuasive can one be before he borders on being coercive and invades the other's capacity to act voluntarily? How is voluntary to be defined? Does it preclude ambivalence, unconscious elements? It would appear that both he and those of us toward whom some of this criticism is directed equally have the delicate tasks of dealing with nuances, quantities, degrees, amounts. A great deal depends on benign human factors, on how considerate, sensitive, and democratically oriented the hands on the rheostats are in those vital human interactions. In relation to civil liberties, a key issue for Dr. Sires and for me, if I believe that in the balance, that prepositional phrase is critical, that in the balance, suicide prevention did more harm in the way of abridging civil liberties or to the personalities involved than it did good in saving lives, I would endorse everything that he had said. I recall some years ago when I was at the Los Angeles Suicide Prevention Center, we, Doctors Littman, Tobochnik, Farborough, arranged for a consultation with a well-known civil libertarian, a prominent and currently active attorney for the American Civil Liberties Union. He came to the center, and for part of a day, we put a number of questions to him, many that anticipated Dr. Sires's concerns, and all of which reflected our own concerns. In essence, as I recall it, he said that if we acted in a citizen's best interests, using our best professional judgment, he could not view that as an abridgment of the citizen's civil liberties. In citing this, I am not trying to prove a case. I'm simply reporting our continuing concern with this topic. No one can say that suicidologists are unmindful of it. I reflect that in general, as I know the studies on the authoritarian personality and related topics, that I would surmise that individuals who go into suicide prevention, either as professionals or as volunteers, are by and large, admittedly with some conspicuous exceptions, on the liberal civil libertarian side. Indeed, I would believe they are especially concerned with the individual's liberty, his psychological rights to continue to live in the face of oppressive inner and outer torment. To dimensionalize the problem as civil libertarian versus suicidologist would not be accurate. Indeed, it may well be that suicidologists, by practicing suicide prevention, are operationally, indeed, among the most effective civil libertarians in the world. In the end, after all these words of mine and quotations from Dr. Sires and my comments about them, there remains one key operational issue which I now put to you in the form of the following question. Could you, in good conscience, send for help a highly lethal suicidal loved one to someone who espouses Dr. Sires's position, assuming, of course, that you yourself were not ambivalent about that person's living or dying?
With an ongoing rebuttal to each other's positions, first Dr. Sires.
Everybody knows that words mean how they are used. Now, if suicide is not a disease, then what do people involved in the suicide problem do in mental hospitals, treated by doctors. Then this is an obscenity, analogous to saying that Jews are not vermin. If they are not vermin, how come they are gassed? Like bedbugs. But if it's not a disease, ladies and gentlemen, then everything I have said holds, and there is a tremendous practical, political, civil rights issue, because interventions are daily undertaken. It is part of the mental hygiene law of virtually every state, perhaps of all 50, that if you are dangerous to yourself and others, then you are committable. In excess of 700,000 people are committed every year in this country, which means are in prison, many of them under the subterfuge of being dangerous to themselves. Now, evidently, Dr. Schneidman doesn't believe this is true. This is fancy double talk. This is like some psychiatrist saying marijuana really isn't bad. But what does he do about it? Nothing. When people are picked up and locked up and stigmatized. American Civil Liberties Union does not say anything about health. In English, it says American, that's American. Civil, civil, liberties, and union. What does it say about mental health? Yet it has always minded for the last 40 years, it has gone so far as to draft commitment statutes in the 1920s. I reference this in the Manufacture of Madness. They were actually drafting model commitment statutes, ladies and gentlemen. Now, that's no different than American civil libertarians in the 1820s drafting specifications for good plantations. Even Thomas Jefferson was in that business, drafting the Declaration of Independence and being served tea by his slaves. Nothing new about this. So the whole issues of civil liberties, I think, is a false issue that he brought, that Dr. Schneidman brought up, and brought up on the basis not of substantive argument, but on the basis of authorities. He was quoting authorities. To me, authorities on these matters are people like Locke and John Stuart Mill and Bertrand Russell and Camus and Sartre. Now, Dr. Schneidman spoke, without elaborating, about the survivors in a typically psychiatrically paternalistic way. He spoke of the survivors of suicidal persons as though they were the legitimate clients of psychiatrists or psychologists. They are American citizens. And until they ask for help, they are none of his business, any more than mine. And what, by what right is he suddenly so concerned about them? Secondly, if he's so concerned about them, and he speaks about the stigma of suicide, I would like to point out that the organization, that the reason why there is a stigma about this is precisely because of his organizations. The manufacturers of medical and psychiatric stigmas for the last 200 years have been psychiatrists. They make stigma like Ford makes cars. This would hardly need documentation. After all, students in psychological institutes spend a good deal of their time reading the garbage that Freud wrote about famous people in which he degraded them, in which Leonardo da Vinci is not a great painter, but is a feces smearer and a homosexual. And this is a classic paper in psychiatric history. And then we talk about stigma. Well, that's where the stigma comes from. There is a stigma associated with anything that the government can do by force to the citizen, because it is in that act that the concept of badness is defined. Badness is not defined in dictionaries, not in a social science encyclopedia or any other dictionary. If the government can do something to you, then by common sense, that is bad. When the government changes that, then it's no longer bad. 3 years ago, if you performed an abortion in New York State, you went to jail. You were a bad man. Now, if you don't perform, now you can perform it and Blue Cross pays for it. And you're a great doctor and make $300,000. So this is an operational definition of the societal meaning of bad, not the moral one. That's why it's important to distinguish between moral, religious concept of bad and legal ones. The legal ones are meaningless from a moral point of view. They're just conventions. Well, then, the cry for help, which presumably I don't answer. Well, I can't help but assure you that if anyone cries for help, professionally speaking, and is willing to underwrite his crying with a little money, I'll be perfectly happy to help him. Now, of course, if he doesn't, I don't. And in being so honest, I am no doubt much worse than other people who only do this free. The country is full of people who work for free, especially professionals. Now, as far as helping, just helping, there are, of course, endless quotations on this. But actually, one of my daughters found this, and it's a classic. And I'll read this one to you, because what else can I say about the helpfulness business? I mean, everything has been said on that score for thousands of years. I have nothing to add to this, so I'll quote. If I knew for certainty that a man was coming to my house with a conscious design of doing me good. I should run for my life. That's from David Thoreau, in case you know. Well, perhaps under the same category, I could touch on the term benign intervention. Now, to call what he does benign intervention is simply not fair play. You know, I don't mind playing games, but we should play by the same rules. I think it would be rather inappropriate for me to define doing something to somebody who doesn't want it as benign. And I don't quite know what I can do except point this out when he defines involuntary psychiatric interventions as benign. This becomes a kind of a definitional process. I mean, who has the power to make this definition? He, the patient, I don't want to arrogate the power to myself. My general position on psychiatry and the English language is that in psychiatry, as in medicine, the patient should define what is illness, what is cure, what is treatment, and so forth. Not the doctor. The doctor should be able to define it for himself. The patient should be able to define it as far as the intervention goes. If somebody wants to define lobar pneumonia as not illness and stay home and not, you know, and go to a Christian Science healer, obviously, he should have that right. Now, that's a definition I don't share, but I should not be able to impose it on him. Now, similarly, the issue of benign intervention, I think, is very distracting. I was rather amused by the being called oxymoronic, but it occurred to me that it's really, I'd rather be oxymoronic than psychodynamic.
And with his response to Dr. Saz, here again, Dr. Schneidman.
I'm willing to say that in this, I'm more of an extremist than Dr. Saz. I see from the remarks he's just made that he's much more moderate and in the middle on these issues than I am. Apparently, I'm willing to speak for those who are willing to do more at the risk, admittedly, the risk of interfering more. I think that that's a concise statement of my position. I'd hate to be drowning in his presence. I say that seriously. And I wouldn't go to him as a patient, and obviously some of you would, and there are differences in attitudes. Quoting Camus, one can then quote Kierkegaard and Heidegger on the same issue, but really I was distressed when the Nobel Prize winner Kawabata committed suicide 2 weeks ago. It was a kind of innocent, stupid, native gut reaction. And had Kawabata come to me, this is all nonsensical imagining, there's a, you know, problem of Japanese and so on. But had he come to me, I don't think I would have tried to dissuade him. I know that I would have tried to dissuade him for many reasons, because he saddened me by his death. And I've read A Snow Country and A Thousand Cranes with some interest, and that life cut off prematurely is a tragedy. I'll leave it at that.
I think that Dr. Schneidman is pretending to a kind of compassion, which is simply a way of making me look cold and brutal or something, which I repudiate. I was quite struck by this Japanese man's suicide, and since it happened just recently, I got the clipping. I'd like to read to you something about it, because he was so distressed by this. His words were premature death. That's what you said, Dr. Schneidman. Nobel Prize-winning novelist Yasunari Kawabata committed suicide Sunday in his workroom at an apartment house in Zushi, a seaside resort city near here, police reported. Period. Next line. He was 72 and had been in ill health.
I was aware of that.
So one should be hooked up to lousy machines for the next 2 years and live like a cadaver? That's your idea of death? There is no time to die?
Where does that say that?
I'm asking you.
No.
Is there a time to die?
Tell me.
It's not a waste.
Tell me where it says he's going to be hooked up to a machine.
Are you denying that gerontology is this kind of a lousy medical game?
The fact is that so far as anyone can tell in this country, what he was in anguish about was the suicide of Mishima Yukio, and that this is a very complicated event, and you suddenly go into gerontology and give us a dramatic image.
Well, he was 72 years old. That's not exactly a spring chicken.
That's a smart aleck remark, but that's not the point.
No, that's long enough to live.
Oh, really?
Well, some people think so.
Oh. Well, you frighten me.
gentlemen, and I use the term loosely. Dr. Saz, how do you assess volition? If a person comes to a suicide prevention center and says, I want to kill myself, do you infer volition from his verbal behavior, in which case you might infer that he wants to kill himself, or do you infer volition from the fact that he came to a suicide prevention center, in which case you infer he wants to live? Or is volition, perhaps, as Dr. Schneidman suggests, not a unitary concept? If people want to both live and die at the same time, how does this affect your position, which is somewhat redundant?
Well, I don't understand the question. It doesn't seem to me that anything I have said hinges upon a denial of the concept of ambivalence, that people want different things at the same time. When most people go to Las Vegas and play roulette, I imagine that they would like to put their money both on red and black and win either way. That's human nature. This is not a problem. A person who comes to a suicide prevention center or to a private psychiatrist for that matter and talks about suicide is a person who is troubled, who wants to talk about suicide, but has yet have not put it into action. Again, it's a matter of plain English. I don't understand what the question is. How does it affect what position?
This reinforces my notion that Dr. Saz does not understand ambivalence. The person who goes to Las Vegas wants to win. And red and black are the procedures and the details of getting to the goal. And if that's his example, that's a very poor example.
As a suicide prevention center volunteer, parenthetically not a psychiatrist, would you have any feelings about my sending help to someone who had called, for example, after having taken an overdose of drugs?
Again, I would want to make this highly operational. If this person has given you their name and address and has told you that they have taken a drug, I would have absolutely no objection, because that to me would mean that this is what they were asking for. I think the tricky issue comes up what happens after the ambulance or the police get there. And let's assume that what happens is, which so often happens, is that what is called a suicidal attempt is in fact not a suicidal attempt, but you know, what psychiatrists call is a gesture. Let's assume this person took 8 aspirin tablets and he now says, leave me alone. And let's assume that her husband says, no, it was 30 seconds. What does the police do then? Or the doctor? I put it back to you. I have absolutely no objection, I'm glad to reiterate this, to giving help. In fact, I firmly believe that psychiatric help, including help about suicide, can be given more effectively if there is no threat of coercion overhanging it. I think I can be more effective in my work with persons who are suicidal because they know that they can talk as freely about suicide as they can about, excuse me, the examples, the stock market or marriage or divorce, and I will not intervene in the one anymore in the other. But I do not get uptight about it. I'm quite willing to talk to them and share with them their ideas about life and death and disease, whatever, and give them mine. And the ultimate decision remains in their hands. So as I said, I'm repeating it, I have no objection to this kind of intervention.
Tom, a patient, this is a true thing. A patient was in my office at the LASPC some years ago, and toward the end of the session, she opened her purse and she showed me a small automatic, right? And she said, I am going to go out and kill that son of a bitch, meaning her husband. Would you agree? What would you have done? But let me tell you what I did.
Patients don't do this to me. They don't play such games with me. You see, he was testing you. You know psychoanalysis. Now I'll talk psychodynamics. He was testing you to see what you'll do. Well, what's the problem? What is your question? What are you asking?
My question is, would you let her leave the office with a gun in her purse?
Well, my position on this is crystal clear. It's not a question of would I let her. I do not construe my role as one of restraining people from killing each other. More power to them. And then let them, but I am in favor, and I am on record for this, of then punishing them severely and not introducing psychiatric testimony to get them off.
Turning to a more moderate key, reached only after a day of heated debate like that you've already heard, we rejoin the debaters for their closing statements and conclusions. First, Dr. Schneidman.
But I point out to you that while I was glad, listen to this, when my 87-year-old, much older than 72, father died last year of cancer of the prostate because he was in such rolling misery, so that I don't have a hard line against euthanasia, that the typical case of suicide and involved in suicide prevention is not an 87-year-old man with cancer of the bladder. It's a 30-year-old young person, 30, 40, 20-year-old, in some kind of temporary dyadic flat. What's the optimal suicide rate for a society? That is, if the price of civilization and crowded living is some tension, would you, if you could, reduce the rate to zero? And at what expense? And that's the paradigm of what we're doing. You see, what's the optimal AWOL rate from an institution? What's the optimal traffic fatality rate in a city? Now, I can be trapped into this, and I'll give away points. I'll say, offhand, I would say that it ought to be zero. But in order to do that, you'd practically have to shoot on sight anyone who entered an automobile. And the price of that, in terms of commerce, daily living, and so on, is simply too much. And so I would say, my answer would be, as low as possible. But then we have to put an asterisk after possible and explicate what that means and its implications. And it simply is not a simple problem. I'm not sure that I'm willing to join with Dr. Saz in a harder law and order line, which I see him saying. I have obsessed since just before lunch with that woman with the pistol in her purse. And it isn't a matter of her husband's being a son of a bitch who deserved to be murdered. And the act of murder does not occur at one temporal micro unit. It's a process. And I believe that the intervention then, what I said to her was, I have to have that gun before you leave. I can also tell you in all candor what I said, with a turn perhaps of inappropriate humor. She said, I'm going to kill him. And I said, the least that'll happen if you kill him is that you'll get 7 years in Tehachapi and it will interrupt our therapy. But I said to her, I'm afraid of guns, and would you close your purse and hand me the purse? I have to have it before you leave. Now, that was a threat. To be perfectly frank, I don't know what I had in mind. After some talk, she handed me the purse, and I gingerly took this pistol out of it. I see that as representative of a kind of paternalistic way of approaching this, and I don't think I'm apologetic for it. My notion of his talking and sending and getting money is that this bullying, and billing is just not quite enough for me.
And in his concluding statement, Dr. Saz.
I am stubborn enough to believe that there are many issues like coins and road signs, where it goes right or left, to which there are only two sides. There are no third sides. I mean, when I speak about voluntary and involuntary psychiatry, I talk about it in political terms, where it is entirely black and white. There is no such thing as involuntary plastic surgery in America. There is no such thing, to take my own favorite analogy, there used to be, but there is no longer such a thing, and it's perfectly black and white, voluntary and involuntary, religion. We have priests, we have rabbis, we simply have no such thing as involuntary Roman Catholicism or involuntary Judaism. The very terms are nonsensical. Well, they were certainly not nonsensical a few hundred years ago. It is in this sense that I use psychiatry. Whether we have involuntary psychiatry or voluntary is indeed, we either have got it or we haven't got it. And I don't see how there is any third possibility. And when I was advocating the abolition of involuntary psychiatry, which I have for a long time, not only in relation to suicide, but actually one can make the best case, probably, for it in relation to suicide. This is what I was talking about. So I did want to re-emphasize this point, lest it become buried in the problem of human ambivalence. An extremely important practical kind of issue that arises the minute you accept at all any of the arguments that Dr. Schneidman or any, quote, suicidologist presents for anything remotely involuntary. And that is that we generally, we talked all day with the assumption that indeed we are dealing with people who might kill themselves. No one has made a murmur about the possibility that people, husbands, wives, and last but not least, of course, professionals, doctors, would, for perfectly good reasons, lie about it and ascribe, attribute suicidal tendencies to somebody where this is a brazen lie. The person has not the least intention of killing himself. But how is he going to prove this? Now, if the fact that someone is supposed to be suicidal justifies certain interventions, then very much like in the criminal law, you must have some procedure for arbitrating whether or not this attribution is made correctly, legitimately. And of course, there are no such methods, because if someone denies it in psychiatry, you know this whole psychiatric mishmash, what happens when somebody denies something which psychiatrists believe is true? Then this becomes really a dreadful, and you know, really the best thing one can do is laugh about it. Because then it becomes either dissimulation, or the person is unconscious of it yet, he doesn't know it yet. He really is suicidal, but he only seems depressed. He doesn't know yet he's suicidal. He hasn't admitted it to himself. So we deal with a whole immense problem of false attribution, which seems to me adds further moral and legal, criminal logic, if you like, weight to my argument for having to do away with this, this kind of intervention. We have talked at great length about something, and I have tried to make this clear. I have not emphasized it because I tried to stick to suicide, that the larger problem is one which is immensely important and which suicidologists, for various reasons, I'm happy to say that human nature is very stable, and that Dr. Schneidman and I are just as far separated as we were at 9:30 this morning. What we are talking about is the technologizing, and more narrowly, the medicalizing of moral problems. Medicine, as a coercive apparatus, must get out of the business if these are moral problems. This is what it necessarily means. Thank you.
And with Dr. Sauce's rejoinder, we conclude this issue of Audio Digest Psychiatry, a biweekly service of the Audio Digest Foundation as a nonprofit subsidiary of the California Medical Association. This tape is copyrighted pursuant to Title 17 of the U.S. Code, prohibiting by law any duplication without written authorization. Until 2 weeks from now, thank you for listening.